Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of A Stab in the Dark, the UK TV podcast that investigates the worlds of crime fiction and TV crime drama, that trudges through dark, lamplit streets, lights up a French cigarette and launches into a 5-minute interior monologue that almost certainly has a moody jazz soundtrack. My name's Mark Billingham, and today in our own ad hoc version of 221B Baker Street, actually a dressing room in King's Place, somewhere in North London, I'm thrilled to say that I'm joined by one of the hardest working and most creative minds in TV drama, none other than co-creator and writer of Sherlock, Mark Gatiss. We'll be talking to Mark about his novels, his love of horror and Victoriana, and of course, Sherlock. We have to talk about Sherlock. So, fire up your pipe. Better yet, fire up 3 pipes. Pull on your deerstalker and settle down in a nice comfy corner of your mind palace. Welcome to A Stab in the Dark. Mark, welcome to Stab in the Dark.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. Now, your career in TV has been incredibly varied. You've been in Game of Thrones, you've played various characters in Doctor Who, a reverend in Midsummer Murders, Peter Mandelson in Coalition, you've appeared in period dramas like Map and Lucia, Sense and Sensibility and Taboo, you were Fanny Craddock's husband, Johnny, in Fear of Fanny, which I've managed to say without giggling like a child.
There's still time.
Okay, then. Ratty in Wind in the Willows, Bamber Gascoigne in Starter for Ten. Mark, to what degree is your choice of roles dependent on how much dressing up you get to do?
Well, I used to be very much about dressing up. The older I get, the more I'm very much persuaded by the notion that someone is just wearing a shirt and trousers.
Oh, right.
You get, actually, Taboo may have been the final straw in terms of sheer physical uncomfortableness. The fat suit and the prosthetic. I was genuinely like, oh my God, this is a young man's game. because of the nature of it, they had to kind of keep darting in. It was like a sort of A&E because the rubber was
moving. It's melting.
Yeah, it was melting. It was so hot. And not sexually. Although that's for the viewers to decide. But I ended up sort of looking like a bruised testicle because they were just repairing it all the time, you know. But anyway, it's still, obviously, it's a lot of fun. But there's a lot to be said for, you know, a nice suit or a T-shirt.
It's a pair of Speedos.
Yes.
Too much effort. Yeah, but even back in League of Gentlemen days, there's always a lot of dressing up, embracing that whole aspect of character.
I think it's why you get into acting is an extension of the dressing up box.
You know? Is it? Is it something you like to do as a kid?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And also, in disguise, you know, I had a proper several makeup and disguise kits. And I had one marketed by Dick Smith, who did The Exorcist and Little Big Man. And I was, as with Reese Shearsmith, actually, when he left school, he did a year with... the guy, oh my God, what's his name? Chris. The guy who designed the Elephant Man's makeup. He wanted to do that. And we have a similar sort of love of those kind of prosthetics. And, you know, when you do, it does make a huge difference to a part when you feel like you're not yourself, whether it's a facial hair or a wig or teeth or glasses or contact lenses. You know, as soon as you don't feel like yourself, it's a big help.
Yeah, but there's a difference between a pair of dodgy false teeth and, as you say, something like you were doing in Taboo, which is a big makeup job. Yeah. I mean, that is what, an hour and a half in makeup?
5 hours.
Just for that, 5 hours? Yeah. And is it true that you've kept... Is there a Doctor Who prosthetic that you kept?
I wish I could show you a picture.
Okay. Of my room. You're going to have to describe it for the listeners.
Yes, I've got my Doctor Who prosthetic from the Lazarus experiment. I've got a pair of prosthetic breasts from a play I did.
We've all got a pair of prosthetic breasts.
I've got a wonderful head from the M.R. James ghost story I directed, and it's horrible, really.
It's going to become sort of...
They're all burglar deterrents.
Yeah, some weird museum after you're gone, people
or
will come round.
Sherlock Holmes did, you know, having a wax model of yourself in the window in case anyone wants to try and assassinate me.
Such a variety of roles. I mean, I mentioned, you know, just touching the surface of them there. Is it a silly question to ask if you've got a favourite?
Well, a lot, really. I mean, I love playing Peter Mandelson. You know, Mycroft Holmes is a version of him anyway. So there's a lot of Mandelson around my career, and I found him fascinating. Wind in the Willows I particularly loved doing. Although we were in Romania for 3 months, me and Lee Ingleby and Matt Lucas and Bob Hoskins, and it was quite grueling, but it was a bit like sort of being shipwrecked together. We all bonded, and we had a lovely time on that. Obviously, being in Doctor Who has always been a life's ambition, so that's been fantastic. And Sherlock, everything really. Very few that I haven't enjoyed.
So is there a common thread between them? I mean, you say, you know, Mandelson is a version of, you know, Mycroft is a version of Mandelson. The Prince Regent in Taboo seemed to me, without sounding pretentious, I think somebody said this to me the other day, quite a Brechtian performance. They said your feelings about the character were writ large, somebody said to me.
All over my face.
But I mean, is there some kind of link, something where you kind of go, yeah, that's a part I can really know.
There's an interesting thing happens where you, it happens to all actors, around the time I was doing Johnny Craddock and that priest in Midsummer Murders, etc., I was playing a lot of broken husbands.
Right.
It's like a theme, you know, to the extent where I actually think I've got to stop doing that now. And I've been recently playing a lot of colonels. I've obviously entered that phase. And a lot of patrician characters, like Mycroft, like Stephen Gardner in Wolf Hall, like Mandelson himself, who are the sort of person who stands behind the throne whispering in the king's ear.
Right.
And that's obviously what I'm currently doing. And what I need to do next is probably play, I don't know. I tell you what I'm playing. I'm playing Robert Cecil, who was James the First spymaster in Gunpowder, which is on, I hope, in November.
Okay.
And it's sort of another iteration of the power behind the throne, but it's slightly different, as he was a 4'4" hunchback. They obviously thought of me, and I am hinting towards his infirmity.
Why does that happen though? Why do casting directors and directors and producers suddenly go broken husband? Oh, we need Mark Gatiss, and then they go, oh, sort of patrician Machiavellian character. We need Mark. How do those shifts happen?
Well, the shifts happen because you do it yourself if you're able to, or you play. You suddenly do.
You do one part particularly well, and then
that's all you're off.
Right.
But I did when I was in London Spy a couple of years ago. I got an enormous amount of attention from playing this very seedy drug dealer. And that was one of those moments when people went, oh my God, I didn't know it was you. And then, you know, I'm still waiting for more seedy drug dealers who kiss Ben Whishaw to come my way.
Now is the time to advertise, Mark.
but I think it's true. I mean, if you look at someone like Joanna Lumley, she would have probably spent her whole career playing slightly glacial upper class women until she played Patsy.
Mm.
And then I think probably all she's ever, in fact, she told me that all she's ever offered is essentially sort of slightly drunken.
Right.
ex-models, though. And what she'd love to do is show her versatility.
Well, something you hinted at then when you were talking about Wind in the Willows is this sort of the collaboration, which is something that seems to have marked out an awful lot of the stuff you've done, League of Gentlemen, obviously a collaborative effort, Doctor Who, Sherlock, which we will talk about later. So what is it that's so appealing about working as part of a team?
Well, I mean, ask anyone who's in a happy or successful team. I mean, it's like being in a band, I suppose, and there's a group sensibility like we had with the League. It was just, we're all kind of brought together by a similar sense of humour and just having a good laugh. And then Steve Moffat and I have known each other for years and have collaborated on various things. And it just, you know, if it works, then you sort of cherish it. And also it's much less lonely.
Yeah, well, this is what I want to come on to, because you also write novels, of course, which is a completely different experience. Yeah. Do you need both those things? It's like, you know, having you sit there on your own working on a Lucifer Box novel. Now, God, I need to go out and work, talk to people and go out and be involved with a team.
In a way, I mean, I particularly like if I've been sort of stuck behind a desk for a while, if I then go and do a play particularly, and you suddenly find yourself in a room with basically a lot of new people, and you've got weeks and weeks to spend on one particular thing, I find that the social aspect of that is really attractive. But it's not so much about feeling kind of isolated and lonely. It's because there's also a wonderful thing about being completely, as they say in Seinfeld, master of your own domain. Mm. You can actually think, right, this is me, this is my thing. But equally, it's so great to have any kind of sounding board. I can't tell you how many times I've been faced with what feels like an intractable problem, and one or two conversations with a friend to sort of freeze it up. It doesn't even have to be, you know, it's like, it doesn't even have to be the answer. It's just like, oh, it makes you think slightly differently.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the really appealing things of team writing or any kind of collaboration.
I think there's certainly no, it's not coincidental that most of the great comedy is written by teams, certainly, or double acts or whatever. Yeah. You need that sounding board. You've got to bounce things off people. Things just get funnier and funnier when you start sharing them.
So.
Well, that is the theory.
In theory.
So I mentioned the Lucifer Box novel. So where did Lucifer Box first come from?
It was a commission out of the blue from an editor at Simon & Schuster to write a book. And in that slightly terrifying blank page way, I thought, I'd love to. What?
But it wasn't something you'd thought about doing before.
I went out for lunch and I said, you know, the thing I'd sort of, somewhere at the back of my head, I've always quite fancied doing is a sort of Edwardian James Bond.
Right.
And that's really where it came from. So it was, and I mean, I'm a huge fan of crime fiction. And I suppose the idea of creating, you know, of having one of those moments where you think, well, what's my detective like?
Yeah,
what's my investigator?
I can create from scratch. Yeah,
and of course you then run up against all the usual problems, which is like so many things have been done. The way that Christie sort of drew lines from Sherlock Holmes to get Poirot, I think it's
oh yeah,
Poirot.
Oh yeah,
and then you go through all those lovely sort of semi-forgotten ones like Max Carrados. The blind detective, and you have to think, what's my detective's thing? Because they all have to have a thing.
But did the era come first? You'd already decided I want to set it in the...
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's always been a sort of favourite of mine.
Why? Why is that era so appealing to you?
I don't know. I think, really, since childhood, I had a top hat when I was a little boy. I did.
Hat and a sort of dressing up box and a prosthetics kit.
All those things. Yeah. And it's just always... I love it. I think it's... You know, I love Conan Doyle and Edgar Rice Burroughs and H.G. Wells. I've always had a kind of affinity for it, really. But I have to, funny enough, the thing is, your tastes change, and mine have really changed. I feel slightly like as you'll see on Saturday in my new Doctor Who. Although I don't know when this is going out, but my next Doctor Who, the Victorians are on Mars, and it's a sort of Edgar Rice Burroughs, H.G. Wells kind of tribute, bank holiday tribute, and I find that sort of story really easy to do and great fun to do. But having said that, I do like the challenges of a totally new era. And as I've got older, I sort of, my tastes have changed. I feel like, I suppose, steampunk, Victorian, that kind of thing, it feels a bit done now. And I'm much more interested in other periods, really.
But that period was incredible just for crime writing. I mean, just some of the people you've mentioned, obviously, you know, Conan Doyle, Wilkie Collins, Edgar Allan Poe, we can probably chuck Dickens into the mix. Yes. What was it about that era that threw up people that you know, were writing detective fiction to that level? I mean,
well, it's not the golden age, which is later, but it really is the beginning. So, I mean, it's who knows which is the first one?
Well,
Poe has a claim, Collins has a claim.
Inspector Bucket is, I think, the first detective, sort of detective inspector or whatever. But I don't know.
But I know that came about because Dickens edited a series of articles for his magazine, either Household Works or All the Year Round, which was about real policemen. Mm. And it was very popular. And I think he probably saw something in that, thinking, actually, this has got something. He's got something. The investigative element. And like all these things, you think people sort of back into them. They don't actually think, I think I might create detective fiction today. It just suddenly becomes something. And then obviously the Moonstone and DuPont, and it's all sort of at the same time in that way that, you know, how many people actually invented the light bulb. It kind of all happened at the same time.
And the great thing, I should imagine, about setting the Lucifer Box novels when you set them, so many things you don't have to worry about that those that set their detective novels in the modern day do. You don't have to worry about CCTV and mobile phones and social media and all that. But research, I guess, on the other, you know.
And what I did with the when I got to the end of the first one, I kind of thought, because they were all meant to be Edwardian, and I'd actually worked out stories for the other two. One was about absinthe, and one they went to the moon.
Of course they did.
And I thought, when I got to the end, I thought, you know, I think I've sort of done all I want to do with this. So what I did was, I just thought, oh, this is exciting. I'll make him 20 years older and set it in the 20s and 30s. Do it like a John Buck and Dennis Wheatley. And then the third one, when he's in his 70s, is set in the early 50s, and it's like early Fleming. So I sort of did the three big stages and made it Lucifer Box into an old man by the end, you know, which was delightful. Because as you say, it's a different thing, tons of exciting research and the fun of it.
Well, that same period is also the horror genre really started to gather momentum round about the same time. Obviously, horror is something that's very important to you. Is that something that was there from an early age, along with the Top Hat and the dressing up, the love of horror? You had all those books of old Hammer horror books and so on.
I had the Herbert Van Thal, the Pan Book of Horror. Do you remember those?
The little compendium short story books.
And there was one particularly one with a hand coming through a grave with an eye in the middle. I couldn't look at it. I was so frightened. First horror film I saw was Brides of Dracula, and I was four. And I've often told the story now, but I used to sort of think that my parents were extremely liberal about it. And I've said it so many times, and it suddenly occurred to me that, oh no, we were just watching it because it's what my dad wanted to watch. Right. It's actually the complete opposite. We just did what he wanted to do.
Yeah, funny enough, my wife is exactly the same thing, that she would sit up on a Friday night, it was always Friday night, watching those Hammer, late night Hammer horrors. And it's a very fond memory she has, actually, of sitting up watching those
films. Well, I've sort of resurrected it. I watch horror films on a Friday night where they should be, at least an hour earlier, because I always fall asleep there. But it sort of, there's something Proustian goes on. There's a flavour to Friday night horror which has never gone away. And even though I'm now choosing what I put on, which is usually Italian giallo, schlocky rubbish, it still feels like it's come on just after the sports report. And it's the last thing on Tyne Tees.
I can remember certain moments from watching those shows. The moment when Christopher Lee appears at the top of the staircase, you know, the first moment Dracula appears. I can remember kind of jumping out of a chair, and Oliver Reed in Curse of the Werewolf and stuff. And how old would I have been? I mean, but I can remember them in much more detail than I can remember films I saw last week.
Yes, absolutely.
Weird.
Well, they have, you know, it's all formative stuff, isn't it? And you never quite get rid of that.
So that history of horror you did for BBC Four, that must have been like a, yes, please, this
is
the job I want to do.
It wasn't my idea. I mean, that's the funny thing. It looks like it is, but BBC Bristol just emailed me saying, would you like to do a three-part history of horror films? I went, yes. and that was that. And it was, you know, 7 years ago now, and I got so many people just in time. Gloria Stewart, who was in The Old Dark House and The Invisible Man, was 100.
Oh, my God.
By the time it broadcast, three of them had died. And John Carpenter had a seizure the week of broadcast. And the producer texted me saying, is it us? He was all right, though, John Carpenter.
So as a fan of horror and a fan of crime, what do you think the two things, you know, what are the common threads between crime and horror as genre? Is it just the storytelling? Is it just that story is so important?
Well, it is, isn't it, obviously? But I think it's much more varied than that. There's a thing which you should call, I suppose, the romance of crime, which is, I think, something we all ascribe to. There's a reason, maybe something very deep in the British psyche, a love of crime and murder, true life and detective fiction. There's the puzzle element in the best books. And the reason I would say that Christie survives and Dorothy L. Sayers doesn't is that Christie's books are brilliant puzzles. Sayers' books are actually rather good literature, but the cases just aren't there. And what you actually want when you're sitting around the pool is a puzzle. I think that's very key to it.
That's true. I mean, a lot, almost every crime writer I know would say Sayers is a better writer than Christie, but Sayers is not the one who's still being adapted for sort of cutting edge, you know, TV dramas anymore.
But you know, there's a famous Billy Wilder quote, which I'm always re-quoting, when he did Witness for the Prosecution, a reporter sort of said, "Why are you bothering with this?" And he said, "Agatha Christie's characters, her dialogue I could write in an afternoon, but her plots are like fucking ball bearings." And it's true. And that's why she survived. She has much. She had like 35 of the best ideas anyone's ever had for a detective story, just one after another.
And actually not as cosy as people
suggest. No.
I mean, you know, Agatha Christie was writing about serial killers. Agatha Christie did all sorts of stuff that is still being replicated in one form or another. The latest thing I gather on the sort of crime grapevine and talking to publishers and so on is the crime horror mashup, or certainly the crime supernatural mashup, seems to be an awful lot.
Can we call it Crora?
Crora or Hash? Better not call it Hash. I don't know what we call it. But anyway, it's coming. There are a lot of books out there like that.
Let's call it that.
What does that kind of light your candle? Do you think the idea of a crime novel with a puzzle at its heart, but that has zombies and monsters running about?
Probably not. Only because, as I say, my tastes changed a lot, and I kind of like ghost stories are my favourite thing of all.
M.R. James, you're big. Why? What's so special about him?
I mean, I think they're fantastic. You know, I love monsters and all kinds of, but there's just something very lyrical and particular about trying to scare someone. And if your story can actually scare you, that's an amazing achievement, I think. You know, it's not about horrifying you, or if you can really frighten. I've had that. When you read a book and it actually makes your hair stand on end, that's an amazing experience. But also just I love the paraphernalia of them, really, the mechanics of it was a ghost story. And it's what James always said, that ghosts have to be malevolent. That's it. That was his big thing. And obviously there are loads of different types of stories in which ghosts aren't they. But his big thing was, no, they're out to get you. And I like that a lot. A sort of horror crime mashup. I mean, it's not really a new idea because there's lots of stuff which is like that. But if it's more, I suppose, if it's being more deliberate about, you know, a murder within a zombie apocalypse or something, then I suppose it's a new iteration, isn't it?
Who cares about a murder within a zombie apocalypse, though, when you think about it? Yeah. I mean, the stakes aren't that high. Yeah. If they're eating anybody that moves, one murder's not going to bother.
I wouldn't read it.
Well, we will be talking to Mark a lot more after the break, quite possibly about a certain TV detective series. But before then, it's that time in the show when our roving reporter goes out and about to bring you more of the best crime fiction and TV crime drama. So with that, it's over to our man with the spyglass, Paul Hirons, who spoke to one of the stars of UK TV's very own Victorian and Edwardian set crime drama, The Murdoch Mysteries. Paul, it's over to you.
Yes, thanks, Mark. I'm here with the lovely Helene Joy, who plays Dr. Julia Ogden in Murdoch Mysteries. Now, if you haven't seen Murdoch Mysteries before, it stars Yannick Bisson as Canada's very own version of Sherlock Holmes, Detective William Murdoch, who solves crimes of Victorian-era and later Edwardian-era Toronto. And Helene's Dr. Ogden is Murdoch's wife, a progressive pathologist and psychologist. And what's great about Murdoch Mysteries is that it's set at the dawn of the 20th century, where forensic detection techniques, science and pragmatism are just beginning to take hold in a world that has to get to grips with political unrest, the suffrage movement, and lots of other social and spiritual shifts. So, Helene, welcome to A Stab in the Dark.
Thanks for having me.
What do you particularly like about this period?
It's funny, I've grown to love it over time. You know, the way in which I look on the show has always been a beef for me. You know, no matter what you do as a woman, when you go into Victorian times, you end up looking, you know, 10, 20 years older. It's extremely conservative, you know, and constrictive and all of those things. But the funny thing is over time you start to really enjoy the formality of it, because it's actually incredibly elegant and beautiful.
What other aspects of the Victorian era that are difficult to kind of get your head around, would you say?
Well, for me, it's just all of the formality that came with the dressing and the clothing and the appropriate behaviour. You know, it's hard for us to wrap our heads around the fact that you just couldn't do and say and be the way you wanted to do and say, you know, be. There were rules, written and unwritten, you know, I mean, if you go back over the process of us getting divorced, of me marrying someone else and having to get divorced and marry again, the trouble, I mean, it's something we take for granted now is you can have choices, you can do what you please. But those choices just weren't there. And so life was so much more difficult in so many ways.
It was a particularly kind of volatile time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was an extremely difficult time worldwide for women. And that kind of repression, I mean, after a while, physical repression and social repression, you know, things have to break. And this, you know, the turn of that century, all kinds of things happened all over the world, you know, with the suffragettes. And so our audience just absolutely loved seeing that storyline and knowing the history of it specifically in Canada. I mean, obviously, we know a lot about what happened in England, but in the other countries, it happened even later, and it happened, you know, with even more resistance. So those storylines are fabulous. And also, yeah, I mean, abortion and the fact that everything was illegal. I mean, young people today just have no clue what the freedoms are like and how difficult it was for women. So I love it that we touch on all of those things, and there's always so much for Julia to be involved in.
People keep going back to that period of time because it is a time of change. Do you think that's why it's so enduring, why people love to see those kind of stories?
I honestly think that people crave history. You know, our modern culture is lacking, you know, and I find that a lot of people, sort of young and old, want to see our heritage. Particularly in Toronto, we don't have a lot of shows or any other shows that are talking about Victorian times in Toronto, and I think it's illuminating. People don't know the history of their own town.
And just finally, Helene, have you always been a fan of Victorian crime fiction or drama or that period in particular?
I absolutely haven't. I, prior to doing this show, wasn't really, I can't think of one show I would have watched on the regular like that. But since, I've obviously embraced it, and I love stuff that's in that period. And also outside of that period, crime shows. I've kind of gotten all into it. But yeah, never before. I guess 10 years, it just worn me down. I love it.
Well, on that bombshell, I think we'll let you get back to your adoring fans. Thank you, Helene.
Thank you very much.
And if you want to watch Murdoch Mysteries, Series 7 starts on UK TV channel Drama from Saturday the 5th of August at 8 p.m. And just a quick word about the brand new Series 11, which you can watch on Alibi early next year. So that's about it from me and Helene. Back to you in the studio, Mark.
Thanks, Paul. So we're back with our special guest, Mark Gatiss. And before the break, we were talking about your love of the Victorian and Edwardian eras, your love of the horror genre, of thrillers generally, which inevitably brings us to Sherlock.
Never
heard of him. Quite a popular show, apparently. If we can go back to the start, you and Stephen Moffat sitting down in your office, wherever. Where did the idea come from? You know, well, let's relaunch Sherlock. Let's reinvent Sherlock.
In my head, it's like the Paget illustration, you know. We were chuffing along.
There's the moor outside.
on a back projection.
Yeah.
Just going around in a psych.
Yeah.
We were both working on Doctor Who, and we've known each other for about 25 years or 20 years, something like that. And we always ended up sharing the same carriage, and we just started talking about other things we liked, like James Bond and Sherlock Holmes. And we sort of did a slightly careful dance around admitting that we liked the Rathbone films the best of all of them, and actually of those, the ones which were brought up to date. And in the dramatisation, in which we've actually been amalgamated into one character, a ginger, grumpy Scotsman, there would be a light bulb moment where I said, we should do that again. And it came about, mostly the big idea was, we were in the middle of another Afghan war, and I said, isn't it funny that in the original stories, Dr. Watson is invalided from Afghanistan.
You're being in Afghanistan, again. I perceive.
And it was like, just one of those like, oh God, that's a great idea. And from there, tumbled all these, oh God, this is exciting, isn't it? Because, you know, it's a flat share, isn't it? It's a flat share. They'd still live in Baker Street, probably above an Indian restaurant or something. And he'd be a kind of younger, we could do the first meeting. Oh my God, you could do that. He could be a younger, geeky man who stays up too late on his computer. Nobody knows what he does. This war hero comes back who's lost his will to live, essentially. They meet, suddenly everything changes. It's like it's ready-made. And it was so ready-made that it took us about 3 years to mention it to Stephen's wife, who was a producer. And she went, why the hell are we making it? That's how it happened. We just kept saying, someone's going to do this. It's a great idea.
Because it's the character that endures, isn't it? I mean, I'm a massive Sherlock Holmes fan. And my first exposure to him was at school at about 11 with a crazy maths teacher who got bored in his own lessons and would pull a battered copy of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes out of his bag.
What a kind
and,
man.
And he was Len Bowles, who was called, and he would read us the short stories instead of teaching us maths. And even though a lot of those details of the plot, of, the arcane details of the plot, it's the character that it straight away just gripped you. And just.
Well, what we realised, well, as soon as we kind of came up with that, was... what's kind of got in the way for a long time is are the trappings. And we thought, as soon as... I think that the one that really made us think was there was a version of Hound of the Baskervilles with Richard Roxburgh where and Ian Hart, where he's being sort of pitched the case by Dr. Mortimer or Henry Baskerville, and they're in King's Cross Station or something, and he nips off and goes in the toilets and shoots up. And you're going, no, it's... He doesn't do it because he's an addict. He does it because he's bored. It was like, oh, all this stuff is getting in the way. And actually, as soon as you strip it away and just go, it's exactly the same, except it's now, then the focus immediately falls onto the eternal brilliance of Dr. Watson and Sherlock Holmes and their characters and their friendship. And it was a very simple decision, heretical seeming, except it had been done before. And then everything just falls into place,
But I think there's some of those things that people think heretical aren't heretical. It's like you say, the trappings kind of get in the way. When the Guy Ritchie movie came out and, Robert Downey Jr. is chasing about all the places, oh, they've turned Sherlock Holmes into an action hero. He was always an action hero.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there was a review of the last series of Sherlock and it said exactly that. And I responded in verse, as Doyle did, to exactly that point. It was like... have you not noticed? He is an expert boxer, single stick and fencer. He's always knocking people out, and he's a man of action. That's what's exciting. He's also clearly a manic depressive. He spends a fortnight sitting on the sofa just staring into space, and then he can't be stopped, and he doesn't eat. And he's just got limitless energy. It's sort of textbook stuff, isn't it?
And mind like a racing engine, and it was always that thing of, for me, that science was, this incredible new force when Conan Doyle created this character and said, I'm not going to have a detective who solves things through intuition or God or whatever. It's this incredible new force. And you've updated that as well, that so science becomes, all sorts of computing.
Well, there was a big question. There were certain things which were immediately, fun. He's not going to smoke a pipe. So why don't we give him nicotine patches? Becomes a three-patch problem. There's lots of nice little jokes. But then we gave him the hat by accident, and then it becomes like, he's still wearing it, but he's wearing it because people expect him to wear it and that sort of thing. But the big one was like, what about forensics? Because Doyle sort of invented it. So if everyone does it, what do we do? And really, the answer we came up with was essentially, the police do all that, but Sherlock is still the man in the room who can link the impossible together. So Lestrade will have all the DNA and all the fingerprints and everything, and then Sherlock will say, yes, but don't you see his shirt was untucked? And they go, what? And then everything follows from that. And really, it's about still preserving him being the cleverest man in the world.
But because all those little jokes are in there, the three-patch problem and so on, you're obviously a massive fan of Sherlock Holmes. Did you go back, reread all the stories?
To be honest, no. I think it's all there. And what we always do is go back to Doyle, really, when we're choosing stories to base them on. But also, if you're stuck... The best thing is just to go back to Doyle. Not even, as I say, not even necessarily for an answer. You'll find it just by spending time with him again, because he's just so brilliant. And I've said this many times, but there's a beautiful story called The Case of Identity,
which is an early story. I think it's the third or fourth story. And it's very hard to dramatize because it works on paper. It's about this girl whose engagement is broken off. And her fiancé is very softly spoken and wears dark glasses. And it's actually her father, her stepfather, who doesn't want her to leave home because if she gets married, he'll lose her income. So he basically meets her at a dance pretending to be this man called Hosmer Angel and then breaks her heart. And that's what it is. But obviously it's quite hard to dramatise that.
Right.
But within the story, there are so many just sort of diamonds of little pieces of human observation and clever deductions and sweet little things. I've gone back to the story like three or four times because it's just got little nuggets of things that you can place elsewhere, you know. And Doyle is just so rich with that. And also not just the home stories, but all his stories, because he was such a master, you can find these funny little nuggets or ideas which are forever useful.
And he was such an incredible character. I mean, it's almost like you couldn't invent Conan Doyle, could you? You know, the writer, the adventurer, the guy that played cricket for the MCC, played football for Portsmouth, all this, you know, absolute sort of Renaissance
spy man,
who also believed in fairies.
Yes, I know. It covers the lot. One of my absolute favourite things in the whole canon is not Doyle. It's Christopher Morley's introduction to the complete Sherlock Holmes. Because the first thing I had was The Adventures, which I was given as a present when I had German measles. And then I got The Lot. And Morley's introduction is one of the most beautifully written things. It talks about the whole notion of fandom is all there. But also he talks about what an incredible man Doyle was. And he says exactly that. No one conceivably
had
this
breadth.
He was a whaler. He used to do this thing in the Boer War. He used to send hidden messages to prisoner of war camps in South Africa. And he used to prick out letters, sending messages, but he always started with the third chapter because he deduced that the people examining it would probably examine the first two chapters more closely and then give up. People always give up after three. And all these amazing things. And then he became, his son died, then he became a spiritist and believed in fairies. I mean, it's just, what a range. He says he is an infracaninophile, a helper of the underdog. A lover of the underdog, isn't it?
Lover of the underdog. I did a speech for the Sherlock Holmes Society a month or so ago, and Conan Doyle's, whatever it would be, great-great-grandson was there. And I couldn't stop staring at him because he looked so much
really?
Like him.
Yeah.
And I was just imagining him with this
maybe
sort of moustache.
And
well, it was really weird meeting him and shaking his hand. It was astonishing. How quickly did Benedict Cumberbatch enter the picture?
Well, he was our only choice. We did we drew up a vast list of everyone who was alive and was vaguely right. But it just clicked. I'd worked with Benedict on Stars for 10. That's how I knew him. Steve and Sue had just watched The Imitation Game. No. Steve and Sue had just watched Atonement. And we sort of crossed texts about him. And it was like, you know, there's something here. He came in to read. I read opposite him as Dr. Watson, and it was immediate.
He nailed it straight away.
You just go, oh, this is just right. Then we saw about six people for Watson, and all of whom were very good, but it was just, you know, Martin read with Benedict, and it just lit up. And Steve leant over to me and said, there's the show.
Oh, there it is, isn't it? It is the show. I mean, that chemistry is obviously hugely important. But it's not just Holmes and Watson. I mean, it's, you know, it's Holmes and Mary. It's Holmes and Mycroft. It's a show about relationships, I think. Mm. You know, the whole... And that chemistry was there very early on, certainly between Benedict and Martin.
Yeah,
right?
And then we were very lucky. You know, there was actually episode two, we didn't want it to become like a family show, as it were. So there's a different detective and sort of Lestrade, and we try, and then we thought, no, actually it is that. And really, without it becoming too cozy, it's a sort of precinct show. You know, you do have that. I mean, Mycroft obviously is only in two of the original stories, but it became something to do with my involvement. It became much more of a fixture. to a greater or lesser extent, you sort of enjoy spending time with those.
But again, same as Moriarty, though, isn't it? I mean, again, it's one of those sort of myths about Sherlock Holmes that, you know, oh, it's Mycroft and Moriarty. And however many few stories they appeared in, but you need them.
It's the Rathbone thing again, because, you know, they did... It was almost always Moriarty, and if it wasn't Moriarty, it was someone who should have been Moriarty. You might as well call him Moriarty.
Yeah.
So... it's a sort of about printing the legend. And the big thing for us was the original plan was to do hour-long episodes. And we were going to bleed Moriarty in and only have him at the end of the first season. And then we made effectively a pilot, which was, it wasn't really a pilot. We had the idea and they had a little bit of money left. So we made episode one. And then, which everyone was very pleased with. And then the BBC, because of Wallander, as 390s, and been a big success, they said, would you do it as 390s? And we went, in fact, Steve and I were having a Doctor Who meeting and Sue rang and said, they'll commission it today if you do 390s. And we went, yes.
Yeah.
So that's how it happened. But then that had a big immediate impact, because as soon as you're doing film length stories, you have to sort of bring everything up. So we brought Moriarty into the first episode as a notion. And by the end of it, they're already sort of having the first version of the Reichenbach Four, which, you know, it's just because film length just eats story, and you have to have a proper scale to it, I think, to, you know, so what we lost in that process, I think, was probably things like, we probably would have done bottle episodes where Mrs. Hudson and Lestrade have to solve a case because Sherlock's away or something like that. And you could still sort of do that, but it would be like 15 minutes of a larger episode, you know.
So are there stories, without wishing to pin you down and go, are there any more? When's it going to be on again? Are there stories that, you know, you haven't covered yet that you're... I mean, there's a lot of stories.
Yes, we haven't actually done both of our favourites, the Red-Headed League and the Speckled Band. We've done little references to things. But it's more... What we've always done is use them as a sort of jumping-off point, because... You know, with the best will in the world, if you actually dramatised one of the short stories, it would take 20 minutes. So you don't want to just sort of bloat it into something it isn't. There's, if you think of something like Scandal in Belgravia, the first 50 minutes is essentially the story, and then it takes off somewhere else. And Hound of the Baskervilles is the framework of the book with lots of other stuff. So it's not really a question of running out of stories. There's always stuff... And we've regarded everything as canonical, everything that's been done. Why not? Sherlock Holmes in Washington, Sherlock Holmes in New York. If there are good things, there's a specific thing we quoted, i.e. stole from a Rathbone, from The Woman in Green, because it's just a fabulous moment, which is Moriarty coming up the stairs and you can hear Sherlock playing the violin and he hears a creak on the stair and he stops. And Moriarty stops and then he starts playing again and up he goes. Gorgeous, sort of Hitchcock moment. And, you know, you find those all over the place. So there's still a lot to do. I think lots we could do potentially. We left the last series in Rathbone Place as the last shot, sort of saying we could pick this up or we could leave it. What I think we realised completely retrospectively, and it wasn't our intention, is what we've done over the four seasons is do their backstory. And that wasn't the plan. But funnily enough, the whole idea of Sherlock and Mycroft having a more combative relationship is from the Billy Wilder film, The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, which is our favourite version. And all those other bits and pieces, which saw Sherlock being much more troubled, we realised that actually we've got them to a place now where they'd be, if we did another one, they'd be sort of like the Rathbone and Bruce versions, as it were. They're sort of comfortable in their skins. They're a little bit older. They've now become the two men on the side of the fireplace that we usually see them being.
Yeah.
And we've kind of accidentally done how they got there.
Right. Well, you say if we do some more, obviously the appetite is there from the public for you to do some more. I guess it's just a question of you all being available in the same place at the same time. You're hugely busy. I think that guy Cumberbatch has got a decent career on the go.
Something like that.
You know, he's probably doing some adverts. but I guess it is just that, isn't it? Trying to find everybody's availability.
It's not lack of will. It's a nightmare to schedule. And it was very, very hard to schedule the last series because of Martin and Benedict's availability and Steve's and mine and everybody. But is it, and not, but there is always genuinely that sort of Fawlty Towers principle of let's just leave it, you know. And we've had the keys to Baker Street for a while, but one of the wonderful things is, you know, they're always shared. They're shared while we were making it, but. You know, there's nothing wrong with saying, right, that's our version, somebody else go and do theirs now. So
people are listening to this and weeping into their tea.
I like
give them something. Give them, dangle them something. Dangle them a carrot.
I don't know. We honestly, we don't have any immediate plans. But I think if we said, you know, would everyone like to do another one? I'm sure we met with a very happy response.
Okay, well, just before we finish, I do have to ask you about the reboot of the Universal Dark Universe. These classic monster movies being remade. Johnny Depp as the Invisible Man, and
is that happening?
Javier Bardem as Frankenstein's monster getting refreshed. Yeah. Good news, bad news.
My terrible suspicion, i.e., I'm sure it's a fact, is that all they want to do is very, very quickly do House of Frankenstein because of Avengers Assemble. I think they want to do these films so they can very quickly have the Invisible Man.
A big franchise, isn't it? Yeah.
Because actually House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula are the original mashups. Did you know, amazingly, that RKO wanted Val Lewton to do a mashup of his monsters, all of which are psychological horror films which don't have monsters in? They made a poster. The film was called They Creep By Night. Cat people.
Yeah.
Zombies. It's true.
They're all creeping. They are all creeping things.
but I think that's what they want to do. I didn't know they were doing Invisible Man. And
but presumably, if they came, call, who? What, is there a monster you'd like to play? Is there your monster of choice? Your creature of choice?
I've done Dracula for audio, which I loved doing. That was a great treat. Well, they're all very attractive. I just want to work my way through the Aurora glow in the dark models.
Right.
there's never been a great mummy film, and from what I've heard, the new
Tom Cruise one.
But there's never been a great one. It's a brilliant idea. I think that's never quite.
Did the Hammer one, Christopher Lee?
It's boring, that film. It's sort of real time. It's and I'm going back 3,000 years.
Right.
It's got some wonderful bits in it, but it's a real slog. I don't think there ever has. I think that's a tough one to get right. But I like, you know, I love the idea of people, you know, having a crack at these. They keep coming back because they're always with us.
Yeah.
It's rather lovely that. But
if you were the mummy, you're saying you'd like to get, you know, more attracted to parts now where there isn't quite so much dressing up and
no, it's
discomfort.
You know what I'd love to do? I think it would be a brilliant thing, is something about Boris Karloff spending hours in the makeup chair with Jack Pierce. I think there's a two-man play in that. That's a good idea. Because they had a very interesting relationship, because they spent hours together while Pierce put the colloidal bandages on him and all that sort of stuff. But ghost stories are my favourite thing, so that's what I'd like to do more of, definitely.
Okay. Now, as promised, in each episode we ask our guests to come along with recommendations for a good read and a good watch. So, Mark, what have you read recently? Well, it doesn't have to be recently. Something that you'd recommend to our listeners.
Well, I have, actually, funnily enough, in the last year or so. Suspense.
How to create suspense?
Have a cup of tea. I was researching something, and I came across this list of rare crime books, the titles of some of which were so hilarious that I probably ordered them all from Abe Books. And this is no joke. There's a novel called They Rang Up the Police. He Should Not Have Slipped. Death in Hospital. And what's it called? Oh, gosh. There's one about a vegetable marrow. I can't remember. Oh, what's it called?
The girl in the vegetable. The girl with the vegetable tattoo.
Actually, They Rang Up the Police is a very good book. That's the one I really liked. Despite its ludicrously prosaic title, which is why it's rather gripping. So I would recommend that if you could find it somewhere.
Can you remember the author?
Oh, I like it. I can email you all.
They Rang Up the Police.
And Death in Hospital. It's
well, go and get
it's
all
so
these.
Ordinary.
Go and get all these. And what about something on TV that you've enjoyed? That you'd
recommend? Well, it's just RuPaul's Drag Race for me, which does have a sort of semi-murderous element. In terms of crime or horror, I don't know. Gosh.
I tell you what, I'll slightly duck this, if I may, because... Oh, it's called Vegetable Duck, that book. There we go. It's called Vegetable Duck, which is a recipe I didn't know about, which is essentially a kind of vegetarian thing with vegetarian mincemeat in a marrow. It's very popular in the 30s, and in the book is used to poison someone.
And they make it look like a duck. Is that why it's called Vegetable Duck?
It looks like a marrow. I've seen a picture. It just looks like a marrow. Okay. The thing I've been hugely enjoying are episodes of the 40s CBS radio series Suspense, which are all available, almost all on free online. They're roughly half an hour long, and when I go running, I listen to them. And it's The Man in Black, the original version, and they're just fantastic. Most of them written by John Dixon Carr,
okay.
Scored by Bernard Herrmann, and fantastically hokey, but delightful. And as they get more and more popular, they get the most incredible people. I've just listened to Sorry, Wrong Number, which is what the film's based on, with Agnes Moorehead. Orson Welles is in one. They do the ABC murders with Charles Laughton and Elsa Lanchester. And they just fantastically... It takes you straight back, 1941, this crackly East Coast broadcast of these often very neat little stories, lots of locked room mysteries and stuff.
You should listen to Sorry, Wrong Number after you've listened to They Rang Up the Police. Surely one is a sequel. That is about it for this episode of A Stab in the Dark. In this episode, what have we learned? Well, we've learned that Mark likes Sherlock Holmes because he got measles and that he got a top hat instead of Sabutio for Christmas. We'll be back again next time with more fantastic names from the worlds of crime fiction and TV crime drama. But in the meantime, you can find out more about A Stab in the Dark at uktv.co.uk/astabinthedark, or get in touch with us on Twitter, #astabinthedark. Plus, don't forget to review us on your podcast app. Your feedback really does make a difference. So if you like the show, please rate and review us. If you don't, well, that's entirely up to you, obviously. But remember, I am the Napoleon of podcast hosts, and my revenge will be swift and merciless. Oh, and just a quick reminder, you can watch the very best crime drama every day on UK TV channels Alibi and Drama. So with that, it's a huge thank you to my very special guest, Mark Gatiss, and thanks to our producers, Paul Hirons, Joel Porter and John Lemon. My name's Mark Billingham, and thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.